The U.S. Geological Survey is basically the federal science arm of the Department of Interior. And many of the biologists in the 1990s were moved under the U.S. Geological Survey to basically help land managers address management issues that they are facing. And so that is done through the ecosystems mission area that has various programs, program components, fish and wildlife, land and water, biological threats, and there's also 40 cooperative research units, of which one is actually here at MSU that typically are associated with universities. The one we have here is a fisheries unit. Just a quick overview of USGS. The U.S. Geological Survey, the ecosystem mission area, has 17 what we call science centers, and you have one here right in your backyard. And we do a lot of the work that I mentioned in the previous slide. We have a lot of specialty in aquatics, fisheries especially, energy development, decision support tools, invasive species, all the important current issues that are important to land managers. One of those, of course, is also wildlife conservation, and that's really where the grizzly bear component fits in. We have a strong large carnivore program. We do work on grizzly bears, but also on black bears and wolves and other predators. So switching from that into the topic of the night, this presentation will essentially be in five parts. And as part of the presentation, we'll try to solve a little scientific puzzle that we were faced with a number of years ago. So in the first part, I'll provide a little bit of background. And I always start with this slide because to me, this is the epitome of what Yellowstone represents. Gorgeous, large landscape, and the animal that belongs here, the iconic species, a grizzly bear. And to me, this resembles a little bit of the American West that we've lost in so many places. Here we still have it right in our backyard. It's a humbling experience to be out in these places, and I think that's certainly what attracts me to working with bears and working in these remote ecosystems. Quick overview of brown bears in general. Grizzly bears, brown bears are the same species. In the brownish color here, you see the current distribution worldwide. As you can see, they're still pretty well distributed throughout the northern hemisphere. There's about 200,000 brown bears in the world. These red areas are areas where they have gone extinct in the last 500 years. Range covers about 45 different countries and 44 different populations. As you see, we have lost quite a bit of habitat of range in North America and in Europe as well. Honing in on our own continent, you can see the historic distribution in green. That's pretty generic distribution. But you can see we've lost a lot of range in North America. And in fact, in the lower 48s, we've lost about 98% of occupied range. What is currently occupied is pretty contiguous in the northern areas, but as you go further south, and as you see in Yellowstone, this population still remains an isolated population. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later on in terms of the implications for genetics and such. Now, Yellowstone National Park played a vital role in the fact that we still have a grizzly bear population in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. This large protected area was essentially a refugia for species like grizzly bears, but a lot of other species as well. And this Yellowstone was at the center of a lot of grizzly bear issues and a lot of controversies in the 60s and 70s. In those days, as many of you know, it was not uncommon to see a lot of bears in these open pit garbage dumps in the middle of the park, where basically the refuge from hotels and et cetera was dumped. Also some areas right outside the park, and that attracted bears, of course. Without going into a long story, there was a lot of controversy about that. The Park Service moved to a more natural management and decided to close these open pit garbage dumps to bears, and that caused bears to start roaming around looking for alternative food sources. And even though that was the right decision in hindsight, it caused a lot of controversy at the time. A lot of bears died and had to be removed from the population because they were causing trouble. And so in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, we were very close to the point of possibly losing this population. Some of the lowest estimates from that time period might have gone down to about 136 is one from one study is one of the lower estimates. In reality, it was probably a couple of hundred animals that were still left in the entire ecosystem. But regardless, this was a time of peril. And that is the reason that the Department of Interior listed the Yellowstone grizzly bear and the other populations in the lower 48 states as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 1975. The other populations, I just mentioned those, so these are the recovery zones that the Fish and Wildlife Service designated in response to the listing. Of course, we'll talk this evening about Yellowstone, but we have one other healthy population, that's the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem. We have about 45, 50 bears in the Cabinet Yak Mountains, about 85 in the Selkirk Mountains, including the Canadian portion of that. That recovery zone actually goes into Canada. And then we have maybe a handful of bears or maybe no bears left in the Northern Cascades. That population is not sustainable into the future. And there are some efforts on the way, or at least considerations to potentially do a reintroduction. The Secretary of Interior has been supportive of that. The Bitterroot ecosystem has no bears at this point. So the Interagency Grizzly Bear Study Team was actually formed in response to those controversies that occurred in Yellowstone at the time. We were formed in 1973, and the notion behind it was that what managers felt like what was needed was a entity that was impartial and provided credible science so that managers can make better decisions on behalf of grizzly bears and to help the recovery of this species. So we were established as an interagency team. We now have 8 members. The U.S. Geological Survey is the coordinating agency of the Grizzly Bear Study Team. We have several other federal agencies, the National Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, and we have 3 state wildlife agencies as partners, and then a tribal partner through the Northern Arapaho and Eastern Shoshone tribes. And the way we function is actually pretty unique. There's not a lot of examples that I can think of where it was set up like this, but it is actually turns out it's a very effective way of going from research to management. So we were established in 1973, then another entity, a policy entity, was established in 1983 called the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee. We report to that committee, we report our science, and that committee consists of high-level managers from states, federal agencies and tribes as well, and they have the power to make decisions on the ground. They can affect management on the ground. So this is a direct link from science to policy to management. And that's actually one reason that the recovery program, I think, has been successful. So what does that recovery program actually consist of? In those early days from the science, it was clear that the limiting factor for this population was not going to recover unless this was addressed, reducing female mortality. You have to have enough female survival that is high enough so that it sustains the population and allows growth of the population. So reducing that mortality was a key factor. How can you do that? By setting habitat standards, by limiting motorized access in some areas. Not everywhere, but in some critical areas. Limiting livestock grazing, retiring livestock allotments within that recovery zone where the core of habitat is, limiting the number of new developed sites and things like that. And again, because these managers had the power to make those decisions and implement it on the ground, they actually ended up being effective. Another important component of the recovery program is to have responsive conflict management. That means primarily the states and the National Park Service responding to issues when human-bear conflicts occur, and they invariably will occur anywhere you have bears and people using the same landscape. Information education is very important. There was a lot of misconceptions about bears in those early days, and that really continues today, where I think that has been very important. And of course, the research and monitoring, what we'll really be talking about tonight, has been a critical component of the recovery program. So our task as a study team is to monitor the long-term status and trend and occupied range of the grizzly bears, but also to respond to managers' needs to address their management challenges. When they have issues with human-bear conflicts that are increasing or changing, we tend to do research in response to that to address the questions that they have and help managers make better science-based decisions. So let's start looking at some of the science and some of the findings from all this work. You know, this has been a major effort, long-term commitment to understanding the bears in this population. And we'll start off with range expansion. It's been a pretty phenomenal change. So I'll point out a couple of boundaries here. This yellow boundary is the recovery zone. So that is the core area where there's a lot of habitat protections in place right now. The purple area is the current, it was the occupied range in the early, or in the 1970s. So about 15, almost 16,000 square kilometers. That's a little over 6,000 square miles. Look at where we are now. Huge change. We have an occupied range that's more than fourfold of where we were in the 70s. So that is a really positive thing. About 25,000 square miles. And this boundary here is, which we have referred to as the demographic monitoring area. That's an area that essentially encompasses most of the suitable habitat. As you can see, most of that area is now occupied. So all these areas within this blue line are basically occupied. Bears are expanding now beyond what we would consider the most suitable habitat. This is also the area where we can actually monitor the population. We really don't have the capacity to monitor beyond those blue lines. Now, basically, I'm going to show you kind of the same thing, but on an annual time step starting in 1990. And what you'll see here is range expansion over time all the way through 2016. The darker area is the female occupied range. The green area is both males and females. And what you see is that typically female expansion lags about 5 to 7 years behind that of total range expansion. And notice, especially in the last couple of years, this Wind River Range, this area became occupied, which has been pretty amazing. What is also amazing is that all these little bears are symbols for observations that are technically outside occupied range. And so those are the areas where we can expect bear problems and where we can expect future expansion. And now, of course, range expansion really typically can only happen if you also have population growth. I've never heard of a biologically of a population that's declining and still expanding in range. That would be pretty challenging. And so we've monitored that very carefully over time, and we focus primarily on the females with cubs of a year, those cubs that are less a year or less old. That's a very recognizable part of the population, a very recognizable segment. And so it's easy for us to monitor them. And it's also, it resembles these females resemble the reproductive engine of the population. So by tracking females with cubs, you learn a lot about the population. This is just one method of things that we do to monitor the population. We do a lot of capture and telemetry, so more intensive work that involves live captures, radio telemetry, putting the radio call on, tagging the animal, taking blood samples, taking genetic samples. We take half the laboratory with us. We have oxygen on them. You know, the standards of care have improved tremendously over time. We make sure that of course, this does affect what these bears do for the time. We make sure that the standards of care are high and that we can release the bear unharmed after about an hour of work on us. So what have we found out with regard to population trend over time? And this is where kind of the scientific question comes in, the scientific puzzle that we'll solve here. In the early years, so starting in the mid-80s, we see that the population starts increasing with about 4 to 7% annual growth. That growth started slowing down in about the early 2000s from, you know, about 0 to 2% annual growth at that point. And we wanted to understand that, of course, you know, because usually when something like annual population growth changes, that is indicative of something happening in the ecosystem, something happening with the population that we may need to be paying attention to. So we tried to understand what was causing that slowing in population growth. And we found the proximate cause pretty easily. We have lots of data to look at.
from the telemetry data, for example. And in that early period, so the period of robust growth, when you basically 52% of the cubs that were born made it to the age of 2 years or high as a sub-adult. In that second time period, starting in the early 2000s, that number was quite a lower, was 30%. Amazingly, these other, when you, once you are a sub-adult, no matter whether you're in this earlier or later time period, when you, once you reach sub-adult age, your survival, annual survival is really high, 95% annual survival. So this is where things change. It's these younger age classes that didn't recruit into the population as much as they used to. So that's all fine and dandy, you know, that's, that gave us the proximate cause of what was causing the slowing population growth. But we didn't really know what ultimately was the cause behind that. And so that is where the scientific puzzle comes in, that we tried to solve in work that started in 2013 and actually was really finished up a couple of years ago. And the first thing we looked at is, well, we know a lot of things have changed in this ecosystem with regard to food resources. And probably the one thing that you've heard about is the decline of white rock pine, which is an important fall food source for grizzly bears. And so we started really looking and digging into the food component of this.
So before we do that, it actually is helpful to look at the typical grizzly bear life cycle. And we'll start off in the period of den emergence, which is usually anywhere from March until early May. The mating season is pretty soon after that. So typically May, June is kind of June is the peak of mating. Then bears go through this period of hyperphagia, and then we'll spend quite a bit of time talking about that. That's a period of food consumption where that's all bears do. They just try to get ready for hibernation and just try to pack in the calories. They start entering the dens anywhere from late October to early December. Females go first, and then males will typically be later. For females that have actually bred in the spring, the fertilized egg is called a blastocyst at that point. It's just developed in a couple of stages back in, when they made it back in June. That blastocyst actually is free floating in the uterus. It doesn't implant in the uterus, doesn't start developing until about this time period in late November, early December. So gestation doesn't technically start until that point. Until then, it just kind of floats around. This is the reason that when the cubs are born in late January, early February, that they're only about a pound or so when they're born. Very short gestation period of 8 to 10 weeks. So it's called delayed implantation. It's a great strategy of bears that hibernate to deal with that time period. Then typically, so the cubs are born, the next year as yearlings they stay with the female, and the next year as 2-year-olds they stay through the denning period, and then the family breaks up usually in the spring after that. So it's basically a 3-year cycle. And if you think about, you know, a 3-year cycle, most bears don't start reproducing for the first time until they're about 6 years of age. It takes a while to produce young. And so reproduction is slow. That's why population recovery is slow as well. So as part of our capture efforts, we also, since about 2000, we've done a lot of measurements on body condition, including percent body fat using bioimpedance, just like you can do in a doctor's office or even at home. We can measure the amount of fat in a bear's body. By the way, that was a nice example of a big male bear. I think this one was 650 pounds or so. And when you look at the changes of percent body fat through the season, there's some interesting patterns here. That in the beginning, they actually still have to rely on their fat reserves that they build up from the fall prior. So they come out of the den, there's not a lot of food yet, they still keep losing body fat, they're still surviving on that stored body fat. And then in about June, July, they start gaining body fat again. So this decline is really interesting. It's particularly noticeable for males, actually. And the reason is, well, I guess it's mating season, they forget to eat. They are interested in something else. They're chasing females during that time period, and they actually lose quite a bit of more body fat than females typically during that time period. The other interesting thing is for females, there is kind of a 20% threshold. If you go into the den with at least 20% body fat, and you have bread, you're more likely to produce cubs than if you're below that threshold. So even if a female is pregnant, has bred successfully, but has not been able to gain enough body fat over time to reach that 20%, she will actually typically not produce cubs that next year. So body fat, body condition, food has a lot to do with a lot of important things in the bear world. Now, this is what a bear, you know, it's all about that hyperphagia. This is what a bear strives to be. I think this is really what it's about. And it doesn't get more perfect shape than this, right? I mean, I think this is what I would consider a very healthy bear. So they're really focusing on these high calorie foods. That's what they're packing the calories with. And I've left the first couple of categories blank for a moment because I want you to guess which food source do you think is that 7.9 caloric value? Who would have thought that an insect actually provides the highest calorie gain? Now, of course, you have to consume a lot of them. We'll talk about it in a little bit. So army cutworm moths are important. Vertebrates are important. Trout. White clover, that's mostly in the spring, early summer, and of course white buck pine seeds. So we'll cover several of these. We don't cover all of them in detail, but a couple of the key ones and the more interesting ones we'll go over. Now, white buck pine seeds are really interesting. These seeds, it's a stone pine, and it's really rich in fats and proteins. So for bears, it's just a perfect resource. The problem is the cones stay on the tree. And bears are not the greatest climbers. Grizzly bears are not the greatest climbers. So they actually rely on the work of red squirrels to cache the seeds in these huge middens, these caches where they dump all the cones for their own sake, of course. They want to survive the winter time too. So you see actually one of these cones here. That's all the squirrels were. Well, the bears are smart. They go to these areas in the fall and raid the squirrel middens and get all the seeds from there. And I have to thank a lot of the photographs are from someone working in the Jackson area, Jake Davis. He set up remote cameras and got some just incredible photos of these bears raiding these squirrel middens. And this is where technology helps us understand the ecology behind this. This is a movement track of a grizzly bear, one of our radio telemetry bears. This is through satellite telemetry, so we can actually sit on our computer and literally look at where this animal is going through time. And this is in early August. And this, you see, this bear is kind of exploring these different areas. The green areas are white buck pine stands. Look at what happens a month later. Wow, this is a white buck pine stand. It just found those squirrel middens and it stays there for weeks at a time, raids all those middens and then gains the calories. So the change in pattern in just a matter of 4 weeks is dramatic. We would have never been able to see these type of patterns with regular telemetry where you actually have to fly over and get a location every other day if you're lucky. These detailed locations where we can get them every hour, every 5 minutes if we wanted to, are providing us with some information that we've never had before. So the problem with white buck pine, as I mentioned it already, we've seen substantial loss of white buck pine due to a variety of reasons. Mountain pine beetle, this little bugger, has been a big cause of white buck pine decline. We've had blister rust, we had drought and fire also being contributing factors. And so when we look at it ecosystem-wide, about 75% of mature white buck pine has died in the ecosystem. That's a pretty substantial effect, of course. So we focus a lot of our studies on the response of grizzly bears to that. And what we found was in some ways surprising, in some ways not surprising. What was not surprising is that selection of white buck pine stands declined over that time period of white buck pine decline. Bears are just responding to a changing resource. And they delayed their use of white buck pine by 1 week typically. But we also found that when it produces, it's still a valuable resource that is being used by grizzly bears. And when I say when it produces, it's a masting species. So it only produces a great crop every 3 to 4 years or so. So
grizzly bears are already used to the fact that it's not a consistent annual crop. What really surprises is that one-third of the bears did not even have access to white buck pine in the fall at all. So those bears are able to make a living without white buck pine. And we realize that maybe they're a little less dependent on white buck pine than we had previously assumed. We'll revisit that a little bit later on. Army cutworm moths is a really interesting resource for grizzly bears. It's found at very high elevations, primarily in the southeastern portion of the ecosystem. And bears feed on these moths on these high elevation talus slopes. The moths feed on alpine meadows at night. They move to these talus slopes for thermal refugia during the day. This is usually late summer. And so they hide in these interstitial spaces of the talus slopes. And these little black dots are grizzly bears feeding at these locations. And this is, unfortunately, we had some videos in here that with this system don't work, unfortunately. So what you see here is a bear digging for those moths. And they basically do that from very early morning, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, all the way to 11 o'clock. Then it gets pretty hot, so bears disappear. But guess how many moths they might eat in a single day? 40,000 in a day is not unusual for a single bear. 40,000 of high-packed calories, you can imagine that you can put on some weight with that. Now, of course, we also, know in terms of bear foraging, what we know is that they're great scavengers and that they're also pretty darn good predators. And we've seen plenty of examples of that. And of course, we have a lot of pilots go out to track our bears, and they get to see some incredible scenes like this one. This grizzly bear chasing a bull elk into a river. I don't actually know if it was successful pursuing it, but just the fact that they try is amazing. And they can kill adult bull elk, bison as well, especially during the rut when these animals are more vulnerable. They also take advantage of winter kills. And so what you typically see, and we see this less now with climate change, the conditions are different. We don't see these huge winter kills anymore that we used to, but anytime, right after they come out of the den, you got three different bears looking for that carcass. And that means in places with high bear densities like Hayden Valley, that many of you are familiar with, if you have a bison carcass, bears are going to congregate. And this is where a lot of interesting interactions take place among these animals. And in this case, there were 20 different grizzly bears on this carcass, everybody trying to get just a little bit. And there's a lot of biomass there, so it's worth it for these animals to wait for the right moment. And what's interesting, here's a female with what looks like a yearling. Even females with young sometimes end up in that mix. What you see at these carcasses is a lot of interactions, especially among male bears. So this was a great fight between three male grizzly bears with lots of roaring. So I can only kind of replicate. What bears typically do is they cache a carcass or a kill that they made. And basically cover it up, most likely to reduce the scent reduce the amount of scent in the area, so that other bears are not attracted to it, so that they can claim being king of the hill, so to speak, and claim it for themselves. So they will actually spend hours on a cache like this, and they'll nibble a little bit on the meat, and then cover it back up, and uncover it, nibble a little bit, cover it back up, and they do this for hours and hours and days at a time. Now, so there's really interesting behaviors here, and we can actually, with telemetry data, we can now measure that we have bears sitting on a carcass like that, as opposed to just laying lazy in a day bed or so. Now, you may be wondering, what in the world is a barbed wire doing around this thing? We'll get to that a little bit later, but this is one way for us to collect genetic samples, hair samples, that we can identify the individual with. So that barbed wire was not meant to keep the bear in. I don't think that would have worked. So with the telemetry data, so we get GPS locations at pretty much any interval we want, we get activity data with that as well. And so what you see in these images is these yellow dots are locations where a bear was not active, probably just sleeping, lazing, you know, not doing much. These red dots are dots where bears are active. So this, in this case, we have a what we identified as a carcass later on, but the telemetry signal told us it's a cluster of locations, a lot of activity, it's sitting on a carcass, eating, foraging, etc. Then it goes over and lays in a day bed for a while and comes back. And you see this bear going back and forth a number of times. It's possible that another bear disturbed it and pushed it off that carcass. So we're starting to learn a little bit more about these type of interactions. In this case, this bear really was probably king of the cache because we see active and inactive locations in the same spot. So this is one of those bears like you saw in the previous picture. It just sits on top of that carcass and consumes it and doesn't really move away. So again, a lot of insights that we couldn't really get in with earlier technologies. And because we had those insights, we were actually able to document that carcass use increased in the fall months only, so during the time of that hyperphagia, increased during the same time period that white buck pine declined. That's interesting. So it looks like they're compensating by shifting their diets to other resources. And, you know, this was a pretty good evidence of that, where you know, this is basically the start of white buck pine decline. It kind of reached the peak right in here. This is also where we see the peak in carcass use by these animals. And so in all that research, what we found out was that the diets, and we knew this already, of course, but the diets of grizzly bears are incredibly seasonal. And it's not just the high calorie items that are important. There's lots of other food items that are available during longer times of the years, like grasses and sedges, forbs, roots, berries, and small mammals that they consume pretty opportunistically. So they're not only relying on those major calorie sources, but are very opportunistic about other food sources as well. And in fact, we documented over 260 different species of food that grizzly bears consume. That's an astonishing number. And this is not every single bear eating that many, of course, but from a population perspective, that's still an incredible number of items that they will go after, including even hornets. So this grizzly bear, in another great picture from Jake Davis, he was able to get this photo of a bear pulling down a hornet's nest, eating the hornets. He got stung in the nose and everything. They just don't care. They are some tough animals. So what we learned was that grizzly bears' diets are incredibly variable. They vary by day, literally, from day to day. They're different from season to season, from year to year, from individual to individual, from location to location. And depending on where you are in the ecosystem, you have a different feeding economy. So if you're in the national park, so here's the boundary of the national park, you have bison resources available, the same in Grand Teton National Park. And outside those areas, you're not going to have bison. But in those areas, you might have things like the army cutworm moths. In these gray areas, you have white buck pine and elk. So there's a very varied system. Depending on where you are in the ecosystem, your diet will be dependent on what's available to you. So what emerges from this was that we're dealing with an incredibly opportunistic omnivore that is actually, so far, able to adjust to all the changes that have taken place with regard to food availability, resource availability. So that didn't solve our puzzle yet. What we needed for our puzzle to resolve that scientific puzzle was really long-term data. And this really shows the value of why it is so important, especially on critters like this that have a long lifespan. Some of these animals live typically, you know, up to 20 years, some live up to 30, the oldest one we have is 31 years. So they live for a long time. And you need to study them for a long time to really understand what's going on. So we started looking at population effects. And we did that so our alternative hypothesis was that something is changing in areas where the densities are higher. And so we developed a density index based on all the data that we have available. And what you'll see here is each of these individual cells is about the size of a female home range. The darker cells indicate more bears per cell. and the lighter cells are a lower number of bears. And so you'll see more cells as bear population expands, but also you see darkening of areas in this graphic over time. And that shows you that in places like Yellowstone National Park, Lamar Valley, Hayden Valley, some of the wilderness areas east, you see some increasing densities over time. And this ends here in 2012. You see some areas where, you know, very distinct higher densities. And by looking at that information and combining that with information on cub survival and yearling survival, what we found was that in areas with higher densities, cub survival was lower and yearling survival was lower. And we did that by looking at that change in that density over time. So if you have a lower value, we saw a little bit of a decline starting in the late 2000s. And remember, that's exactly the point where we started seeing the population growth slowing down. At higher densities, that effect became much more prevalent. So this was a pretty clear indication that as areas of higher bear densities increase in this population that's recovering, we're seeing some effects on survival of younger age classes, which is slowing down population growth. And so this gets at this concept of carrying capacity for a population, right? You first, any typical animal population, you see that first increase, like we see with the initial recovery of the Yellowstone grizzly bear population, then that you start slowing down simply because you reach that carrying capacity. So there's these internal mechanisms within the population that have now in portions of the ecosystem, not everywhere, but in portions of the ecosystem where we've reached that limit. And almost any animal population will exhibit that. There's one exception to that. Guess who that is? That's us. So from a biological perspective, as a biologist, I would, regardless of, I haven't mentioned much about delisting, relisting, and all that business, all the policy and politics around grizzly bear conservation. But from a purely biological perspective, when you have areas in the ecosystem where carrying capacity is reached, that means that you have recovery. And that's, I think we can say that from a recovery standpoint, this is a success story. How that is dealt with in terms of listing and delisting is a whole other matter. But I want to quickly review why this has been a success. And one reason is that we had the organizations and people to manage this population. So we had this interagency collaboration among a variety of stakeholders and agencies. Of course, we had the data from the study team, which I think has been critical to the success. We also had the political support. Especially going back to the 1970s, we're dealing with an iconic species, an iconic ecosystem. No politician at that time was willing to see this population blink out on their watch. So there was a lot of political support at the time, and that has continued to date. And of course, the reason that we have a full audience here is that we have had a lot of public support. And public involvement has been great. And that is a whole gradient of opinions, of course, about how this population should be managed. But there's no doubt that everyone comes in with pure intentions of interest in this population. And that public support, I think, has been critical to the success of this recovery effort. So the final part of this is, what about the future of this population? And if you look at this young bear, it's almost looking at you like, yeah, what about it? Because it's us, of course, that have their fate completely in their hands. It's really 85% of bear mortality is human caused. So it is in our hands, and we are the ones that can make a difference or not. One of the issues that was a big factor in the recent debate about delisting and then the relisting that occurred on court order back in September related to the genetics of this population and the future of this population regarding connectivity with other populations. So we have a lot of genetic information about this population. We've been collecting that for every bear that we capture. We have over 100 over 1,000 individuals with genetic information. We can learn from that individual ID. We can learn their who their siblings are and their parents, and build a whole family tree, basically. We learn about genetic diversity and things like that. And we can collect that through these barbed wire enclosures with a lure in the middle. Bear goes under the barbed wire, leaves a tuft of hair. And again, we can look at that hair and identify the unique individual from that, just basically like genetic fingerprinting. And we can also collect passive samples from bears rubbing on objects like utility poles. So this technology has really revolutionized wildlife science. We have our population estimates are better because of it. We have a much better idea of relationships and genetic diversity among different populations. And so when you look at this trend of genetic diversity as measured with something called heterozygosity over a bunch of different populations in North America, what we see is there's generally a latitudinal trend. So what you see is at higher latitudes in places like Alaska, Yukon Territory, more contiguous habitat, bear populations are well connected, pretty high genetic diversity, and that declines as you get to the more southern latitudes. The lowest one in this particular graph is the southern Selkirk Mountains, fairly isolated population, and here's Yellowstone. Relatively low genetic diversity, but I should point out it's still quite a bit higher than some very healthy populations on ABC Islands in Alaska, for example. So there's no sign that this level of genetic diversity is affecting this population whatsoever. In fact, there's all kinds of signs in our data that things are improving in that regard. It still remains an isolated population, though, and it's still isolated from the closest one, the Northern Continental Divide population. That's where new genetic diversity would have to come from if that is going to happen in the future. And to that regard, there is some positive sign. We now, so we're looking at a pretty large area here, all the way from the Canadian border into Wyoming. The occupied range of the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem and the Yellowstone ecosystem is only separated by about 70 miles, actually a little bit less now, 65 miles. As the ranges keep expanding, the closer they get, the potential for genetic connectivity to take place is really much higher now than it has been in decades, and probably even longer. So the potential for this is very good. And we jumped in on that to predict where bears might move between these two ecosystems for that to happen. And so we have all these GPS locations of bears, and we can actually model their movements and model how would a bear go from, say, this area, this is occupied range in Northern Continental Divide, to occupied range in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. And we did that for males primarily because they're the dispersing sex. They're the ones that move the furthest from their natal home ranges. And so we did a lot of fancy habitat modeling and made those predictions. And these darker areas is where the number of paths that cross are higher. So those are the more likely routes that bears would take from one ecosystem to another. And there's some really interesting patterns in here. This, for example, would follow a path that eventually ends up in the Bridger Mountains, pretty close to the northern edge of Bozeman and the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem. Here we have a pivotal point, the Tobacco Root Mountains, that where a number of paths would converge, either coming from here or here. Some come close to the Bitterroot Mountains. We now have a pretty good idea of where they might go to make that connectivity. And this helps land managers because NGOs that want to protect habitat, for example, because we know there's some places, there's a lot more human activity in this area than there is in the core area of either ecosystem. And so we now have the information to tell managers, well, if you want to focus on improving the possibility of that happening, these are the places that you need to go. And pay attention to potential barriers like interstates, like I-15 and I-90. You see places where they would have to cross. What can we do there to mitigate the potential barrier effects of those highways? And we know how to do that. People in Canada have done it, and US 93, Highway 93 in Montana, that's one of the most mitigated highways in the country. We know how to do that. We just need to identify the places where that needs to happen. And the evidence for this model to be pretty good is there. We had records of verified observations of grizzly bears, these blue triangles, that mostly laid on top of those areas that where we predicted the potential movements would be. So we already have bears kind of making some of these journeys out there a little bit. They just, to our knowledge, have not yet made it across. And if they do make it across, then they still have to mate, of course, and reproduce to actually introduce new genes. And this is, by the way, the most scenic mating picture I've ever seen. But if that happens, we will be able to discover that with our genetic monitoring. So if there is ingress, genetic new material from the Northern Continental Divide into the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, we will detect it eventually. I'm confident of that. And I'm also pretty confident that this might actually happen in the next 5 to 10 years. So in terms of that genetic activity, I think things are looking pretty good. But there are some challenges, and the challenges, ironically enough, relate to, in a way, are the result of success. So we now have bears expanding into new areas where people are not used to seeing grizzly bears. Some of that is way out in sagebrush country, on the eastern edge of the ecosystem, way east of Cody, for example, where people haven't seen grizzly bears in decades, maybe 100 years. And so suddenly they show up. And it's like, whoa, what are we doing here? You know, how do we respond to that? And this creates conflicts, you know, livestock that are killed by grizzly bears and red large. We've had a lot in that area. We've had a lot of livestock conflicts in recent years. This is a real challenge for managers. And these problems that landowners face are real. So we have livestock depredations. We also, because we have more human use of those areas, we have a lot of hunter bear conflicts. We have more development and recreation. Recreation patterns are changing, as you know, around this region. And how is that going to affect bears, when, especially in these areas where they basically just colonized? Probably the biggest factor in all this is maintaining public support. You know, how do you maintain public support when there are stakeholders and constituents that feel like there are too many bears in parts of their landscape, when others are saying, no, we want more bears? You know, that's a real challenge for wildlife managers and land managers to deal with. And I think, you know, everybody's trying their best to make that work. And so it really comes down, you know, this is the part where I, as a scientist, depart basically and say, you guys figure it out. But really, this is all about coexistence, you know, and it's kind of like these three cubs sitting around in a circle and like, yeah, what did you do today? I didn't like what you did today. You know, let's talk about it. And so, you know, I'm convinced that we can coexist on the landscape with even an aggressive animal like, potentially aggressive animal like grizzly bears. Coexistence is possible, but it also means that different parties have to talk to each other and understand each other. And there has to be an understanding that landowners deal with very different problems that recreational groups deal with, for example, in terms of dealing with more bears on the landscape. And so those are the conversations that fortunately are taking place. And a lot of entities, a lot of agencies and NGOs are helping with that. And I think there's a big role to play for NGOs, because more and more do we now see bears on private land. This is where more problems are occurring. Those are not areas where federal, state land managers can do much. It's private land. So this is where we need other entities to step in and take take a responsibility. With that, let me finish up by pointing out our website. It's very easy to find. Just search IGBST. We have lots of information regarding the grizzly bear population. We have data on there. We update mortality records, for example. We have maps of occupied range, GIS layers that you can freely get, lots of information, contact information if you have questions. And with that, thank you very much for your attention. The question, in case you didn't hear it in the back, have there been instances where a female mother bear that had cubs of her own had adopted cubs from another female? And this is where technology and genetics comes into play. Yes, we have documented, I think at least in two instances, where, and we don't know what led up to it, but This was, I think both of them occurred in Grand Teton National Park, where we did see that a female adopted cubs from another female. Those two females were probably related, so they were almost like a big family and sharing cubs, but they did actually end up adopting and raising, successfully raising the cubs of another female. So it does happen, yeah. To fully document that, we had to have the genetics to be able to prove that. So, and we can tell which cub belonged to which female. So that's how we were able to tell for sure. Yeah, so that's a good question. A lot of that mortality occurs fairly early on. And so, and this has been documented in other populations as well, especially in these high density areas where male bears may be killing cubs, for example. That tends to occur when these cubs are most vulnerable, and that is, you know, fairly soon after they come out of the den with the mother. That's also, by the way, the reason that once the females with cubs leave the den, they typically stay pretty close to the den and at pretty high elevations, typically away from male bears. So we've definitely seen that in our telemetry data. That's a good question. I should point out, you know, so now we're getting into, so I hadn't gone into a lot of details on this, this idea of in areas with higher bear densities that males are killing cubs. In Scandinavia, with some of my colleagues, they've documented that, you know, pretty good detail. And they refer to it as sexually selected infanticide. And that typically, that only makes, so the idea is that a male bear may kill the cubs of a female, very similar to what you see in African lions. Male may kill cubs of a female that are not, that he did not sire, so that he gets a breeding opportunity. Because that female, if it's early enough, that female will come into estrus again and can breed again. So that would be one way for that male to pass on his genes to the next generation. In his own interests. And so that's typically how it would occur. I have to say though, in North America, that exact mechanism hasn't truly been documented. What we do see is that the probability of cubs getting killed by another bear is higher in the areas with higher density, but we can't really say conclusively that mechanism of sexually selected infanticide is actually occurring here in North America.